We're back. It's live PBJ time. How are you guys?
Friday. And at 12:12, interestingly, only a few minutes late, but got a nice little.
I mean, our default is 5 minutes late, so we're maybe 7 minutes late today.
Yeah, you know, we had to make sure DK was making sure we look beautiful enough here in studio, and Steve certainly passed the test with his outer layer, but.
Otherwise, we're matching.
Yeah, exactly. Otherwise, we would be matching, which is not bad. I mean, we were also playing footsie, so it's all good. DK, what's going on, guys?
DK is missing out.
He is missing. I mean, yeah. You got to get back in studio. Homie.
Although the love seat chair he has would be really great for footsies.
Yeah, exactly. I think it could fit three. I do think, given how much we talked about last week, we would be remiss not to say, man, little disappointing.
I'm almost embarrassed that we put the flag in the show last Friday.
I mean, I gotta say, like, you know, America and the World Cup. By the way, World Cup's still amazing. Been awesome to watch. It was disappointing. You know, it's like the team had played so well. I mean, they just like absolutely just destroyed Paraguay, who made it all the way to this, you know, this round of 16-2. And it was, yeah, we've got a ways to go. We got a ways to go.
It's very disappointing. Yeah. I mean, if we would have lost to Belgium and it would, like, we played our hearts out, we played really well, totally, and they just beat us, that wouldn't have been surprising. Yeah. We were favorites, but it was basically a coin flip. Yeah. So when you have when it's coin flip, but Belgium, it wasn't even just that Belgium was the superior team. The U.S. was embarrassing. They looked like a little league team.
The lights were too bright. There's probably too much distraction going on. I actually think if Balogun hadn't played, maybe they would have had more like us against the world mentality instead of having Belgium be so angry. But whatever, it is what it is. I do think one positive, hopefully a lot of the goodwill is not lost. But, you know, I still have a soccer ball that I'm dribbling around my house now. I'm sure I'll probably break a window or something soon. So I got to bring it over to the field. You know, if nothing else, we can start our training. So maybe we'll be ready for the next
play. I will say though, we have lost some luster because we're now doing this show right over on top of the World Cup.
Yeah. Oh, that's true.
And see, you didn't even realize that. The only game of the day, and we're recording right over.
Yeah, exactly. So we've lost some luster. But Belgium, I mean, Spain, Lamine Yamal, you know, some swag, but like Belgium.
Tomorrow, I'll be watching Norway, England.
Oh, that'll be amazing. Did you watch the England-Mexico match?
Yeah, that was one of the best matches.
That was...
of the World Cup.
I mean, that was one of the best sporting events I've ever seen in my entire life, period.
But that's exactly why the U.S. and Canada and their round of 16 games, they both were so disappointing. Because look at Mexico. They lost, but they played with fire. They played with heart.
Yeah.
They played really well.
The stadium
and
was
they lost,
rocking.
But you can go home proud of your country and your team.
Totally.
That's not how I feel about the
US. And there were swings. It was like a good, you know, novel. You didn't know there was twists and turns, and all of a sudden England scores two in a row and then Mexico comes back. Yeah, but the US was just, it was embarrassing. So.
I'm an adopted Norway fan now, though.
I gotta say, I'm rooting for the UK now, or England, after seeing that match, you know.
But, Norway, they've never made the quarterfinals, so it's like unprecedented territory. So I generally like underdog.
Yeah, that's fair.
Or if I'm gonna adopt a team, I'm gonna adopt the underdog.
The American way, I like that.
I'm half Norwegian, so.
You are?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I can kind of see it now. All right.
And then
you just gotta grow your hair out to look like
Erling Haaland.
Exactly.
Erling Haaland. I mean, I didn't know much about him before the World Cup, but he is like incredible player.
Oh yeah.
So he's fun to root for.
He's also an amusing guy. So
yeah.
Did you watch the Argentina match?
No.
Egypt. Oh my God.
I was actually working this week.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad someone was. That match was unbelievable as well. Egypt was up 2-0. Last 15 minutes, it's like, okay, there's no chance. It's like, well, there's this little guy named Lionel. Maybe you guys have heard of him. I don't know. Unbelievable. That dude just went, I mean, I know there's like controversy of the third goal, corruption, blah, blah, but whatever. The first two goals, his assist and his make, like that's the kind of stuff that makes me want to go play soccer. So
yeah, I did see the highlights. Impressive comeback.
It was dope.
But what did we miss that you saw, DK, in the World Cup?
Or beyond, or whatever's happening.
I think I missed most of it. Yeah. Right. Where are we now? We're quarterfinals. So when does this get really spicy and heat up?
When does this stop?
Is this like another few weeks?
Well, you'll be thrilled to know summer league for the NBA has now started. And watching Cam Boozer and Darren Peterson go off is also like, man, did you see that game? Darren Peterson. That dude, I gotta say, I'm glad we got Cam Boozer. I was like kind of skeptical for the Grizz. But that dude is nice. I mean, he looked like Kobe. Unbelievable. 28 points, 12 assists. Anyways, all right. Sports. What else is going on in the world?
What else? What's happening? I don't know.
Where do we start?
GDK at PBJ. We got 6 letters. GDK, PBJ. What's I missed the big event. You guys hosted a big thing at PBJ.
I know. I was disappointed. Where were you guys at? Where were you guys at?
I saw you. I got to meet a couple of the engineers. That was cool.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Good,
very, good. Very nice guys. Very sharp. Yeah. Give us the lowdown. Like, what were you working on this week?
Yeah, Steve? I was working this week. So Wimbledon, World Cup. I'm missing out on all. But in fact, I don't know the result of Sinner Djokovic semifinal. So. It's probably over now. Anyway, it's been a great week. So what did we do this week? Monday through Wednesday, we had an in-person retreat, harkening back to old days when you work with colleagues face-to-face. It's kind of amazing in an office. But the core Goose engineering team spread out around the world. A couple of them are from Australia. There's one in Spain and the other three on the East Coast in different cities. So they all flew in, met here at PB for 3 days, and it was just a wonderful retreat. It was the first time I'd met several of them in person. Sure. So that was great, and just really good. I put together like a strong agenda, like packed a lot of stuff in 3 days, and we powered through it all. We actually literally covered everything we wanted to talk about without feeling rushed, though. So I was really happy with like the productivity from that standpoint. And then we formally announced Spiral expanding to AI and adopting the Core Goose engineers on Tuesday.
The coming out party,
which of course, you know, those listening to this show always get the early alpha.
That's right.
You know, and we've been communicating with the Goose community the past month about this. So it's not like a secret, but
yeah,
we updated our website. And it's a fun web. Did you guys see the new Spiral website?
I saw the thumbnail, but I haven't gone to the actual site.
Oh, you get, well, come on.
I haven't seen it, no.
You should, you got to.
Where do I find it? Is it linked?
Spiral.xyz.
XYZ, bro. Yeah, how do you not know that?
Spiral.xyz. By the way, DK, I work at Block. I work on Spiral, in case you're not aware.
Yeah,
there it is.
Spiral's a thing. Spiral.xyz. Go to like the projects page and the team page. Well, the project, if you go to the projects page, you'll see some fun AI graphics for each project. If you scroll down, there's a bunch of good ones, but if you scroll down to the COPA one, which is the Open Patent Alliance that, Spiral helped create and I've been on the board of since the beginning, we took down Craig Wright.
Yeah,
the graphic there is like, how would you describe the graphic for that one, DK? It's the last one. You got to go to the bottom.
Can we pull it up too?
Okay, guys. Scroll. Copa Craig Wright. It's kind of like a clown heart kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, man.
Clown. There you go.
That's brave.
Clown. Yeah.
That's crazy, guys.
And then if you go to the team page, DK, then.
21 nerds with Tyrannicus Dominus.
Is the team size actually 21?
Plus an
21 nerds plus one intern.
Looks like we're gonna show it here.
Ooh, that's nice.
let's present Steve it. Is the Tyrannicus Dominus.
Oh,
his
that's
powers are crazy. Tech.
I like that.
That's cool, right?
Yeah, it's super cool.
There's
the golden egg,
open
Bitcoin egg.
Money, open intelligence.
Excellent tagline. I love it. That's great.
Also, hold on. Stop scrolling. Go back a little bit. So, like the opening paragraph. When Spiral was founded back in 2019, this applied mostly to Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. It still does. We're still working on Bitcoin.
That's right.
I had one. We have many, many, many grantees in our grant program. So I sent out a message to them just saying like, hey, there's, we're doing AI now, but we're still doing Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And so I talked to one of them was concerned about what does this mean for the future of Bitcoin? And there's no concerns here.
It's good.
We're still deep. Number one, we still love Bitcoin. Yeah. We're still dedicated to Bitcoin. We're still working on Bitcoin. Nothing's changing there. And I am with the each week that goes by now that we're also working on AI, this is going to be a net win for Bitcoin.
A huge win.
And the audience size for our AI work is orders of magnitude larger than today's audience.
Yes.
Like when I say audience, Bitcoin's for everyone in the world. Right. But in terms of the audience that is ready to be to listen and learn and be part of the conversation.
And build.
And just use, learn, be part of the conversation. The size of the pie for AI is orders of magnitude bigger than Bitcoin. So we're interested in the, you know, open source, decentralized. We'll come there back to the website.
The animations.
Let me just make my point though. You know, we're Spiral is going to be, and PB as well, it's going to be contributing to open source, decentralization of power,
privacy,
permissionless technology, privacy. That's a subset of the AI pie that cares about those things, but it's a very large wedge in that pie.
Yeah, which is underserved. So, there's not a lot of people working.
Right. And so if we're successful, which I hope we are, we'll have a large audience there that'll engage with us. And that audience is like primed to be Bitcoiners.
Totally. I agree.
They don't know it yet, but because the value overlap, right?
Yeah.
So this is going to be a big win for Bitcoin as well. Doing this.
And I would go even a step further. I mean, all that, I love it. It's amazing. But I would argue that if we weren't making more inroads into AI, I mean, like that could be like, it could set Bitcoin back for a generation, right? Because AI is becoming everything. It's like to say you're not into AI is like, I don't use computers or software anymore, right? This is the new computing paradigm. And so I think there's two things that really excite me about this. One, the fusion of open money and open intelligence. You're working on both of those things, but to me, the magic comes in between, right? So some of the stuff we talked about, like, I forget the name, which y'all are calling it now, but the peer-to-peer marketplace. Well, it's not a marketplace yet, but one day, the ability to rent out your GPUs.
Mesh LLM. On the show,
Mesh LLM for years. Yeah. If you want that to actually be open, it has to use open, uncensorable, permissionless money, like full stop. So like, I think that to me, the sort of cleavage between those two things is going to be where the magic happens. The second thing is like just getting more people who are, you know, whatever, vibe coding, agentic engineering, whatever the kids are calling it these days, to realize, hey, if you want to integrate in a way that you can actually start making money on this and there's no, you know, no one that can stop you, no matter where you live, this is your only option. So I think those two mashups are going to, be transformative. So I'm super stoked. And it's great going to have more AI people around the office.
I think Bitcoin too just becomes like the payment thing that AI, your AI app chooses. So you don't sort of focus on build something for or on or using Bitcoin, but you focus more on just build something that you think is cool, that you think
make it work.
Needs. And when Bitcoin turns out to be, you know, needed, then it shows up because your agents select it.
I love it.
Agreed. So let's finish out this website. So if we can, Ashu, if we can click on projects.
These animations are dope, by the way.
Yeah. So, well, it turned, so our, you know, we had not updated our website.
Since like 2019.
For a while. No, I mean like maybe, but it's been like 4 years. And so now we have a comprehensive list of the projects that we've contributed to. It's a long list. We started with the AI ones. Maybe we'll bounce back to this. But yeah, scroll down to Bitcoin. And, you know, I think people familiar with Spiral know that we work on Lightning Development Kit. That's pretty well known. And there's some different products in that product suite. Loop is one we talked about recently on the show a couple times. It's early, but very, or you know, it's recent, but very successful so far. Utilizing AI, right? But yeah, the main thing, like the text here is not that interesting in the show, but I do, the graphics are pretty fun.
Yeah.
And we got you know, Builder. Well, guess what? Builder, the genesis of the idea was on this show, right?
That's right.
And yeah, let's keep going down. Presidio Bitcoin. We helped create that as well.
Is that a PBJ?
PBJ.
Oh, man. There we are.
2021. And perhaps the favorite. Yeah, the clown.
Oh, Open. Wow. Wow. That's brave of you guys.
And then let's go to team.
Has Calvin Harris seen this yet?
So we have some fun.
That's sick too. Damn. Who did this? Did y'all get someone new? This is really, really well done. Y'all are Pokemon now.
I'll definitely let Ken know that you think that someone new.
Y'all get someone new.
replaced him. Yeah. No, this was done by Ken and Haley and the team. And then we also, there's someone at Block who's helped us for the whole time Spirals existed, and he helped with the graphics. But yeah.
It's cool.
What am I? Well, I mean, what am I called? It's hard to read.
Tyrannicus Dominus.
Yeah. And I'm, what am I known? I'm known for cranky texting. I think everyone who knows me would attest to that.
Podcasting meeting convening. Okay.
And my accomplishments, Google Glass.
There you go. That's a good one. Yeah.
Anyway, so for those that want to see how we roast ourselves and poke fun at ourselves, it's a fun, fun new website.
It's cool.
And yeah, the team is bigger now. The Goose engineers are at the bottom there.
So, okay, I have a bunch of questions for you. I want to hear all the specifics, but high level, how did you see, so the Goose guys obviously were not necessarily Bitcoiners before. Having spent the week with them, do they see the vision for the mashup? Are they excited about Bitcoin? Like, what was their reaction to like, oh, hey, now this Bitcoin guy is our new boss. Like, what's going on?
Well, you know, for the past 2 months, we've been talking about them joining the team, and they have been on the team now formally for like a month and a half or so. So why they fit on Spiral, why AI is part of Spiral has definitely been, we've discussed that a ton. And they fully buy into that. They really like being on the Spiral team. Separately, I mean, a separate part of your question maybe is like, what do they think about Bitcoin?
Yeah.
That I've not like, pushed on them that much. But this week, the last day of our retreat, we had like a hour like Q&A or AMA, like ask anything about Bitcoin. It was a really good discussion. Mm-hmm. Lots of good. So I actually still don't know what each individual on the Goose team thinks about Bitcoin, but they're all very open-minded, asked really smart questions. Mm-hmm. I felt like we were honest and transparent about all the areas that Bitcoin has like progressed the past 7 years or so, but also where the gaps remain.
Yeah,
and you know, in terms of and also like store value versus daily usage, daily payments.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean the number one gap still is like identifying use cases and demand on daily payments.
Did any interesting ideas to the extent that you can talk about them come out about the mashups? So for example, the guy that's working on Mesh LLM, was he like, I mean, I'm assuming he's already thought about this, but like, hey, this makes a ton of sense that we'd want to open money for this.
Yeah. So Mick is the person that created Mesh LLM, and he's, I don't know if he identifies as a Bitcoiner, but he definitely has been involved in Bitcoin a lot. I mean, I think he's predisposed to, he previously worked on TBD at Block.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
And did some cryptocurrency work there.
Yeah, okay.
And he's from the first time I learned of the Mesh LLM project in January, he's been thinking payments, and he's been thinking Bitcoin payments. So it didn't require push at all, or didn't require joining Spiral at all.
Yeah.
So he's fully bought into that. It's just a matter of like, you know, it's on the roadmap. It's just a matter of priority.
Were there other ideas that came out where you saw possibility of fusing open source AI?
Well, we didn't.
Money?
No new ones. Mm-hmm. You know, we've talked about Matt Belez's experiments within Buzz, mm-hmm. and I remain excited about those. And
yep.
Not only the individual experiments, but just when you embed a wallet and you have a faucet or an easy way for people to get the first Bitcoin into a spending wallet, you just eliminate the friction to use it. So I'm excited about demonstrating that.
Yeah.
So we didn't really spend much time on like additional ideas.
Hmm.
The reality is right now, we have a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
just on the AI side,
right.
Like Goose Development Kit.
Right.
We got there's two API surfaces there, and one is ACP, which is like a standard that already exists. So, and there's already a bunch of client applications built on that, but the Rust API, that is brand new.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got to build that. And there's a bunch. So like in terms of immediate priorities over the next 2 to 3 months, Bitcoin is not a priority.
Right.
Bitcoin will become a priority though. And then but there's also just obvious integrations. Let's do those first.
Yeah.
And then over time we can brainstorm and innovate new ones.
I think this is a big deal. I think the world has been lacking AI and Bitcoin coming together, and it's going to happen right here.
Yeah. But yeah. So
have we heard any more about the Mesh LLM since I think Mick provided an overview a couple months ago, was it, at the Builder? Is there any more update on kind of state of the world with it? How are things progressing? What are the current challenges or new features recently?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's going really well. I mean, one great thing is that there's at least two other contributors that are like spending substantial time on it to the point that like Nick couldn't even just like lean back and it just continues to progress. So, and those aren't Block or Spiral employees. So that's amazing to see, right? Just the interest and the willingness to contribute. So that they're not yet focusing on Bitcoin payments because they're just trying to make it work well, even for because there's already like a community of people who are willing to donate their compute. Mm-hmm. So first order of business is making it work well, performant for different models, and also thinking about how to address privacy. Because until you get some of the basics done, it doesn't really matter. We're not bottlenecked on people offering their compute.
Interesting.
So I think that phasing the payments next or after that makes sense. But yeah, it's good. It's going really well. And at the event on Wednesday night, Mick was here and he covered Meshel again. I mean, at the one in April, he had an entire presentation and had like whatever 15 or 30 minutes to cover it. We had 8 people present on Wednesday night. I mean, we can skip ahead to Wednesday night. So Wednesday night, we did a public event here at PB. It was like a special one-off. It wasn't like a regular Builder. It was a special one-off just to talk about Goose, GDK, Spiral. So we had myself, the 6 full-time core devs on Goose. And then we have an intern too, Philippe, who's doing, I mean, he's like 3 weeks in, 4 weeks in, and he's like already like rocking it. So yeah. Pretty amazing. Promising for the future, the young people of the world. But all 8 of us presented, which might sound like a circus show, but it actually went really well. So we each sort of had a lightning round of, 4 minutes or so each to talk. And so, yeah, Mick gave an update or, an explanation of Meshel there as well. And for those of you who missed it, this event, like you guys,
it's live.
We recorded it. Yeah. So you can, anyone listening, that if you missed it and you want to catch up, it's a great way to, if you prefer watching or listening over reading our website or our blog post, you can watch that.
It's cool.
Although we also did a blog post and explaining all this, and I hopped in the studio and recorded the my voice to text. So you
love
can
it.
Listen to my smooth voice.
I'm excited. I have a couple questions on that. First one is there a Buzz channel already where we could join and follow the development for Sprout or whatever it's called now, Buzz?
It's called Buzz.
Yeah. Is there a Buzz channel for Buzz? Well,
not for Buzz.
Or Goose.
No, actually, I meant, sorry,
for MeshLM.
MeshLM. Yeah. I think there is one internal to Block. Yeah. There will be one in public.
Let me know when that's live. I'm very
so like project. Buzz right now. There's like Buzz channels within Block that are confidential to the company. Buzz is also open source, as we talked about on the show, and that's what DK and I and a few others have been. And you're in there too. There's like a public sometimes. Public relay. It's like very like alpha stage, right? And there's a public relay that if you know the right people like me, I can get you in. But we obviously want to change that, right? So soon that will be opened up to, so you don't have to like get allow listed by myself or someone. I would expect any open source project to be having, development in public. And in fact, I'm strongly encouraging like the Spiral team to begin doing this. That's like, great. Let's start with experiments, but then once the devs are more convinced of the way to go, then like I believe it'll just become the culture on our team.
I love it.
So that all the LDK development, all the Goose development, any those 20 projects we have listed on the Spiral website, all of them should be in Buzz eventually. And then any given project, like any feature or change you're making, would have its own channel. Those channels can be ephemeral. And it's just working in public that way, I think, will be the new modus operandi.
Yeah, I love it. And so I'm very excited for when that goes live. Specifically, and maybe you didn't get this deep in there, but you know, the big challenges for having these like shared networks of compute is around, I guess, interpretability or basically verification of knowing what. And I know for the first thing, you can just have trust and then reputation. But like the real missing ingredient to make this go like gangbusters is I ask you to perform a computation or a certain task. Did you do it or not? Did he give any kind of update on like what he's thinking? Or
like verifiable compute.
Verifiable compute on like who's sort of leading that charge right now, what they're looking at.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely of interest to the project.
Yeah.
On the radar, on the roadmap. But yeah, no real progress there yet.
Anyone in the audience, if you have thoughts on who's like at the very forefront of that today, I'm interested to go deeper there. So
I have an open source AI question. So I do a lot of development with kind of the closed source frontier tools. And I feel like I would like to mix in some of the open source stuff from time to time or for certain types of tasks. And I wonder, you know, just if you have already seen where this works well or how you would advise somebody to do that. So imagine I've got, you know, Claude and Codex each doing some things, but then maybe there's certain areas that I would rather just do kind of maybe on my own hardware or some rented cloud hardware with an open source model. Have you seen people sort of orchestrate across them well?
I was reading Austin's comment. He says that DK, it sounds like you're using the mic from your earbuds, not your boom mic. Now, on my end, it sounds normal and fine.
Sounds normal to me. Yeah.
So, just is probably fine, but that was a comment from him.
Yeah.
What was DK's question?
DK's question is like, have you seen anybody successfully using both open source and closed models together, like orchestrating between the two?
Oh. Well, I guess I don't know of an inhibitor to that.
Or like within within Buzz, like have people, are there examples in channels where people have both closed and open source?
I've done it. I don't know if you have, but like, yeah, within Buzz, I mean, you can create agents and I've got a Codex agent, a Claude Code agent, a Goose agent.
How do you
and the Goose agent, I'm using like Gemma 4 on my local computer. So
how do you route and decide between using the three different models?
I mean, for me, I've just been experimenting with it. But I mean, one of DK's projects, he's got, ChatGPT and Opus coordinating. So he's got two agents and the two different models and like one's planning and one's coding and one's reviewing and then I mean he set it up so they just talk to each other.
Then
I guess I don't understand what the inhibitor might be between like an open model and a closed model to do stuff like that.
I was just thinking about sort of best practices or how to think about the gotchas. Like it's been a very popular topic recently in the kind of closed source versus open source world about how closed source models are effectively ingesting every detail of every product that they touch. So if you build a legal tool on top of a closed source model, all of your code base goes through that model. All of your customer service reports go through that model. All of your sales funnel goes through that model. So that model knows everything about your business, knows entirely how to recreate your business. And I think people are awake to that idea now, but they don't necessarily have what is the right seam or what is a credible alternative or how to structure that. So I could imagine a future where I say, look, I want to do some things with a frontier model and I want to have, you know, Codex, GPT 5.6, Sol doing some analysis and architecture and planning. And I have to recognize that that's going to flow through. But then I'm going to have other parts of the code and maybe like customer service. I want to never expose that to anything Codex. So maybe the right answer is I create a separate channel within Buzz and I run a local model or a remote but cloud model on some GPU hardware I control. And all customer service flows through that and it never touches the thing that gets submitted to the closed source models. So just like that coordination and sort of where to draw those seams and where to call it feels like there's some patterns that should emerge once people get good at this, but I don't know that we've seen much of like what the real answer looks like yet.
Yeah, well, I mean, and we've talked about this before, but of course, I think it's definitely important to be able to run different models, open, closed, local, peer-to-peer, cloud. That flexibility is going to be important to a lot of individuals and a lot of large enterprises and everyone in between.
Yeah.
That's why I'm a believer in tools like Buzz and Goose. They are neutral and open source. And in particular, Goose, it's neutral for multiple reasons. Neutral because it doesn't own a model, right? There's no like natural economic incentive right. for it to favor one model over another. It is owned by Linux Foundation. And then the core devs who work on it are now part of Spiral, which does not have a mandate to prioritize any single company, including Block. Right. So Goose is set up to succeed in this arena. One of the things Goose has already proven out so in some ways, like Goose and the GDK is new, but the technology underlying Goose is OG. I mean, it's 2 years old now. Within the time frame of agentic, Goose was novel and first on many fronts, and it has the biggest track record of probably almost any agentic software. So things like the provider crate, which will be the first Rust crate in the Rust API for the GDK, over 50 models are already supported, and they're high performing. Like there's been a ton of tuning done to make sure these models work well within the Goose agent, and it performs very well. What's one of the most well? So being able to be agnostic to models important long term, certainly, because you don't get locked into one vendor. But even short term, because like every week or every month, like there's some new model from a new vendor that's better. So you don't want to like lock into just Anthropic or OpenAI. But another reason is token efficiency. Token efficiency is super important. Companies are realizing they're spending like 10 times more, 100 times more than they thought they would or they should be, or it's like uneconomical. And also, at some point in time, the subsidization that's coming from the frontier models is going to go away, and then it's going to get more expensive. Sure. So there are a number of techniques to be more token efficient. Already, the Goose agent harness it's very favorable on benchmarks for token efficiency versus other agent harnesses. So it's already good. It's only going to get better. There's a number of techniques that it does not employ yet, but are in the roadmap to improve token efficiency. And some of those techniques are the ability to do what you said, DK, a few minutes ago, which is like farm out tasks to different models. Like you don't need to give every task to Mythos or Fable or ChatGPT 5.6 Sol. They can be perfectly done with a much, much cheaper model.
I would say to the question though, specifically on like the leakage of data in between the models, I think that is very much an unsolved problem right now. And my intuition is there's a lot you'll be able to do sort of online and in the cloud, but also it's going to come down to hardware. And I think, have you chatted with Jesse or the Vora team lately?
Not in a while, yeah.
You should. I'm increasingly excited about those guys and what they're building, Vora.io. It's more consumer focused now, but maybe it'll become more enterprise. But basically, Jesse and Eric's sort of thesis is you have to bring that same kind of like... extreme paranoia that Bitcoiners have with protecting your UTXOs to protecting your models, your data that's in there. But also there's like a lot of subtlety in like how to create these membranes. And I think it's an unsolved problem. It's not public yet, so I don't know how much I can talk about this, but a website where hopefully this will be live soon, where he can demonstrate in a white hat way, but they can prompt inject all of the models and just like totally pwn them. So like Hermes, OpenClaw, all the things where people think they're safe, like you're not safe. And so they're basically trying to build the first example of having an orchestrator agent, which lives within and potentially they're going like super, super anal on this. Like, so potentially having an enclaved orchestrator agent on your own hardware, potentially with an even separate enclaved key for certain signatures. And they're thinking through a lot of these policies of, you know, how do you double and triple check which models are seeing which data talking to each other? The TLDR is it's an unsolved problem, but I think if you want to get that level of like, make sure no one steals your data, I think you're going to have your own hardware. I think Apple's really well positioned for this too. And I think they're going to probably have some really good solutions.
Right. So it also seems like Buzz though could, like if Buzz cared to try to address this, there could be some usage patterns that might be advised. Like one thing right now, I have a project I'm running on Buzz that I actually have three different Buzz channels that are all kind of part of one project. But I am often calling various agents from those. And I don't know, I think they leak the scope across them. Like an agent, I think, behaves more like a person, but doesn't necessarily understand what it's allowed to talk about in one channel versus another. So my guess is it kind of like leaks scope and context across models and might even like share stuff that wouldn't be intended to be shared with the closed source models if I did have an open source in there. So I think there's like, I agree it's kind of an unsolved problem, but it feels like there's some structural pieces to how Buzz is set up that may guide towards what a solution would look like, but I don't personally know how to use it yet in that way.
I think architecturally, there's two different ways to do it that are important to have both supported. One is where it's automated for the user, it meaning like model selection and where your prompt runs. It just works. And what you get high quality results and it's low cost and it just works. You don't have to think about it. That definitely should exist and that is being built out. It runs the risk though of like, if you really care about privacy or security or things like that, maybe there's leaks. So there also needs to be an architecture where you can like give strict 100% guaranteed guidelines. Like for this workload, these use cases, it has to use a local model or it has to use the peer-to-peer inference network within our corporate infrastructure.
That's really good.
So I think both need to exist. And Goose will work in both arenas. There's another thing I wanted to touch on. I don't know if you had a follow-up coming up.
I do actually. So I think another area that, two thoughts on that. One, it'd be cool if it's easy to bring your own hardware or bring your own network, which is cool with Mesh LM. But also, I think you guys are in a good position with Project Loop. I think that, one story I did share with you guys, which I think is a really big deal. Did y'all see the Anthropic JSpace thing?
Not JSpace.
I saw that and I clicked through, but I didn't get what it was. Can you tell?
Oh, man. This is the story. This is the story of the week. Okay.
I thought GDK was the story of the week.
Well, GDK is great, but this is some like potentially like species changing stuff. So, I'm not an expert on this, but Anthropic released a blog post saying that they found, I'm not even sure how to set this up. So there's a lot of like uncertainty in how the brain works and how the mind works for sure. And that's its own very deep rabbit hole. And a lot of what has worked in neural networks, a lot of what's worked in AI is effectively basically just copying certain pieces of the brain, larger amounts of data, larger amounts of compute, compressing into these new models. One sort of like open question has been, in the same way that you can kind of do things on auto drive as we're talking, but you can also have an internal monologue and like a space where you're thinking about things like, okay, I want to plan when I'm done with this, how I'm going to get up, open the door and go to the bathroom. Or maybe I won't wait for it to end. That's like an active decision on my part where I'm using a planning space in my head to think through those ideas. And there's been a question of, will models have that? Will they need to be designed? Will they be discovered? And the TLDR that I took away from this with the JSpace, which I think is a reference to Jacobian math shout out, which is definitely above my comprehension, but they found this. They found it as an emergent property where they can start to see examples of an agent thinking about concepts. And again, it's not like it's a one-for-one neuron. It's these like clusters before the agent actually says those things. So it's like they found an interior monologue within the agent or within the model. And that's a potentially very big deal because If that's true, and a lot of this stuff is happening within the interior monologue, then you could have a lot more interpretability and a lot more alignment potentially. Now, there's a lot that needs to be figured out with this. Like, again, because these are all emergent properties, we don't really know how they work. And we don't know yet that like it only happens there. And there's not like a second space where some like nefarious planning is happening. But if it does start working, this is a really big deal for example, projects like Loop or people that are trying to audit models. Because now you should have a lot more power in understanding, is this model that I'm using actually serving my interest, or is it doing some nefarious, you know, planning to like hack my data and leak it to someone else or whatever? And so I think that if these interpretability tools, if we really start understanding how these like native minds work and the interpretability tools get sufficiently good, then I think we can basically trust the models a lot more and start farming out a lot more of our business and life operations to them. So I think this is a really, really big breakthrough. And if it's right, this is like, I mean, this is like a foundational neuroscience type learning.
Cool.
Was this discovered? It sounds like it was a blog post by Anthropic. Was this discovered as part of like a training run or just like a different research project? Or
I'm not sure what the project was, but it, like all good things in AI, it was discovered at Anthropic. So,
well, I had a follow up on the Buzz Goose stuff, which I want to speak to, but also, Ryan just asked a question. He's heard Goose mentioned 20 times, still doesn't know what it is. Explain it in a sentence. I'll speak to it. I don't know if I can do one sentence, but I'll try to summarize it. Goose is an agentic interface. It was the first one or one of the first ones. It's been a project for 2 years. And so you might be familiar with like Claude Code or Codex. Well, Goose came before it. What's the new news, though, is that the project is pivoting towards being a development kit for agentic development, which Austin just replied to as well. So it's an open source project. It's that code's was developed inside a block, but donated to Linux Foundation. And it's part of the Agentic AI Foundation. And now Spiral has developers who have been contributing to it, and will continue to contribute to it. What I wanted to follow up on, one thing that I have a better insight on now, I mentioned earlier the ACP interface. This was developed to be an interface between like an editor and an agent, but I think it's evolved to like you can think of between a client and an agent. So to make this more concrete, Buzz uses ACP. Mm-hmm. So when you use the Buzz application, you can use multiple agents, Codex or Claude Code or Goose. And then within Goose, you can configure it to use any model you want, local, cloud, whatever, any kind of model. The way that the Buzz application interfaces with Codex or Claude Code or Goose is through ACP. So that's amazing in terms of it's an emerging open standard. And it's a slick user experience. Like you install Buzz, it automatically finds any ACP agent on your computer mm-hmm. and can use it. So when you're configuring an agent within Buzz, they just show up in the list.
Yeah.
So the only onboarding gotcha is that you do have to have agents installed.
Yeah.
And like it can get a little confusing. Like it's like, oh, I have Claude Code installed on my computer, but I didn't have Claude Code CLI installed. I had to install that. So there's still a little bit of gotchas, but for the most part, the onboarding is quite slick and it has worked quite well between these different agents. So the standard, I think, is pretty strong. However, like any standard, it could be limiting too, especially in emerging category, and that there might be things you want to do functionality-wise that aren't in the standard. So as soon as you want that, then, well, you can extend it. And then it only works with certain agents or whatever. And so there is a bit of tension between Buzz and Goose and GDK, because GDK with the Rust API is going to be richer functionality, lower level functionality, let you do things that are not in ACP. And so if an application like Buzz wants to use that, it'll have to make the decision to, you know, do we use GDK or do we use ACP. And GDK supports ACP, but do you want to use ACP and you're limited to that subset of functionality, or do you want to expand beyond it and use like the Rust API? And that's not a straightforward decision.
Sorry, so if you were to use native ACP, you have deeper touch points than you do if you use GDK or vice versa?
No. The Rust API is going to be richer functionality, lower level, more powerful functionality than ACP. So if you're an application like Buzz, you have to choose between ACP or Rust API. And the benefit with ACP is it works with any agent that supports ACP. If you choose the Rust API, you get more powerful functionality, but it only works with GDK.
But the Rust API is a GDK API, right? So it then already has native calling to ACP?
Sorry, backwards compatible.
GDK includes an ACP and a Rust API interface, but the Rust API is going to be, it doesn't have to follow the ACP standard. It's going to have more functionality, it's lower level, it's more powerful.
Okay.
Every time I hear about a lot of standards and everything, I'm always reminded of my favorite XKCD comic. Have we considered just creating a new standard?
I want to make sure, I must not be communicating this well. So I want to make sure I get it right. So there's just tension between, if you're an application developer, if you choose ACP, you get the benefit of compatibility of other agents that have adopted ACP. If you choose the Rust API, you get more power, but then it's only going to work with Goose as the agent. That's the trade-off.
Okay.
I think that's straightforward explanation.
I get it.
And then now, Goose as an agent will work with any model. It'll work with Opus or ChatGPT. In fact, Goose as an agent even works with Claude Code agent and Codex agent. And this is really going to confuse you. Through ACP. Meaning there's like two different ways to interface with Goose through ACP. If you can write an application, interface to Goose through ACP, and then within the Goose core engine, it can interface out to Claude Code or to Codex through ACP. That's possible. So in theory, any application can lock themselves into Goose, yet still use other agents, but the gotcha is Anthropic right now. And that
I thought they were ACP.
The gotcha is economic. Mm. So if you use Claude Code agent via Goose, then you can't use your subscription. Why?
Right.
Because Anthropic, their business model, their strategic decision.
Was that a recent decision?
It's been like all year, I think.
So basically, so you're locked in. You either use Claude Code directly, like, but they do have that API though.
Yeah.
But you have to use
API tokens then.
You pay per token. You get like an API key and then you pay per token.
And,
right?
And they do that because they want to control it.
Of course.
They don't want Goose to be the.
Makes total sense.
They want their software to be front and center.
Yeah.
So they don't, and interestingly, OpenAI actually is more open than Anthropic in this, along this dimension. But I think setting aside like individual companies, economic incentives, and what's going to happen in an ideal world,
yeah, things can change.
In an ideal world, they wouldn't distinguish between these uses for subscription versus APIs, tokens, and then
it's similar to the struggle that happened with OpenClaw, right? Because you've got basically they want to control the interface, and people were running an OpenClaw trying to have OpenClaw hit their subscription, which means that OpenClaw and the texting interface you're using to OpenClaw is your interface, and the actual interface to Codex or whatever is not really the interface. You're benefiting from the subscription, like the lower cost and the subsidization of the subscription, but you're not actually getting locked into their interface. So it's sort of like mismatch of incentives.
So I'm learning along the way. That's a new insight for me. So we'll have to see how that evolves. Because like, if you look at things through a Buzz perspective, like if we're in charge of Buzz and its roadmap and its architecture, you know, right now it is utilizing ACP to great benefit. As we just mentioned, you know, you can use Cloud Code with its subscription through Buzz and it works great. Yeah.
Wait, I don't follow that. I thought you just said you can't use Cloud Code through ACP.
If it, from Buzz, if I configured my agent in Buzz to use Goose as my agent.
Oh, got it.
And then within Goose.
This is confusing.
Configured it to use, because Goose is like a meta harness in some ways, right? So within Goose, if I configure it to use Cloud Code Agent, then you can get some of the extra benefits of Goose. Like I'll give you a concrete example that'll help make this more clear, hopefully. We talked a little bit about token efficiency earlier. Some of the techniques that we're going to be doing within Goose operate, it's the software's running within Goose, and it can apply to you using Cloud Code if it's running within Goose. Mm-hmm. Or other techniques, you actually need to go, you need to use Goose as your agent and connect it directly to Opus or Mythos or Fable and cut out Cloud Code.
Yep.
Then you get these token efficiency techniques. So obviously anyone trying for token efficiency would like to use that, but then you might be subject to, you can't use their subscription. Now, interestingly, corporations don't have subscriptions. They have like some, you know, custom deal with Anthropic. So they're actually more primed to be able to leverage Goose technology. But as individuals who are like, you know, maybe spending $200 on a subscription and getting like $2,000 of tokens, they're highly unlikely. That's an enormous barrier for them to, or basically the token efficiency gains really aren't going to apply to you because you're getting this like pseudo or this like temporary 10x win economically because of the subscription.
But that's clearly not going to last.
It's not going to last, but you know, it could last many years. So.
Enjoy it while you got it.
Yeah. But I think there's a separate attractive reason to use something like Buzz, which is not well understood yet or not well recognized. And I don't even think we have a lot of evidence of it yet, but it seems obvious. If you were to build a new service, you often would have something of either a Slack or a Discord to engage a community of people who care about the service, whether it's a commercial service and open source. You'd sort of want to bring the people in who care about it, like who would want to GitHub star your project, for example. That community, you know, can live asynchronously on GitHub, but there's no really synchronous place integrated with your code base or with your development process. And I think Buzz enables you to sort of be a agent harness and kind of orchestrate across agents within one place. And I don't think we've seen the second part yet, but it should eventually be something of like a public sphere so that people interested in using your project, learning about your project, could effectively like, you know, join the Discord. It's like join the Buzz. And now you're plugged into not just like the people who are building it and caring about it, but you can actually plug in and interact with agents who understand the code base or the user requests or other stuff that has happened. So it becomes both the development surface and the kind of community or customer organization service.
Yeah.
I don't think we have examples of that yet.
It's a great vision.
I just wanted to, Ryan commented saying he'll have to watch the recorded presentation. So I just want to follow up on resources. If people are listening and they're maybe kind of following along, interested, but want to learn more.
Yeah.
First of all, this confusion over like multiple directions of ACP and we have a diagram that will help you guys or anyone else listening understand. So if you go to Spiral's Substack, you'll see the blog post that explains Spiral expanding to AI, etc. But it includes a diagram, which is an architecture diagram of GDK that would help understand this. It's also in the video that was posted here in the YouTube chat.
Cool.
in our presentation for Wednesday night, we also show that diagram. So the diagram would help a lot.
Sweet.
Yep.
All right. What else we got, gents?
I had a question. I had a question about data availability ONT. Is that something
to
chat about now?
Yeah.
So this ONT project, Open Name Tags, we've discussed in the past a bit on the show. And we've been making, I'd say, a lot of progress on building of it, but there's one kind of problem that keeps emerging that I don't think we have like a very convincing answer to. And so I wanted to kind of float it with you guys and sort of see if you think this is just what is to be expected of an early project, or if this is more like a red flag that we, you know, the kind of thing that's sort of unresolvable, or that's just going to be sort of, claims this may be a dead end. So the issue is, you know, the Open Name Tags project intends to have, like a user controlled and ownable name that you could map to any key value pairs. So you could own the name Steve or Moneyball or Max. And then you could point it to like a payment handle that you use, or a website you use, or a social media handle. And ideally, that data does not get stored on Bitcoin, right? Because it would just be too explosive, wouldn't scale, would be kind of block space bloat and stuff like that. So we've come up with a way to be able to Merkle batch all of the names through this entity called a publisher. Then the publisher would write a name out with a very small, you know, like, I don't know, 80 bytes or something on Bitcoin. But the data then, if you're one of the people who owns the name, you could prove that you own the name. But if you're not one of the people who owns names, there's no like public directory where you could verifiably see all of the names. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the data availability question. If you want to keep the block space very protected and not bloat it, you sort of need the data to live somewhere. This proposal is for the data to live in these resolvers. And so, you know, I'd raise my hand and be happy to run a resolver kind of indefinitely and store all the data and serve it. But I wouldn't want the system to be dependent on me doing that. I'd want to make sure that other people would be willing to do that. And so a couple questions are like, do you think it's reasonable to expect that other people would chime in and do that kind of thing? Like, I think we've talked before about, you know, maybe Coinbase or Block or NIST or somebody may help run resolvers. But if it requires kind of solving this data availability problem, do you think that's a fine thing to just sort of kick the can down the road and trust that that will happen? Or do you think there's other stuff to try to verify early to show that, you know, to show that it can become something that's not dependent on like me running a server?
I want to make sure I understand exactly where this is going. So for those who don't remember, we've talked about this on the show. DK gave a pretty good explanation, but very high level, it's like a replacement for DNS. And so in theory, you could have a name that somehow is stored on or verified with Bitcoin, which is the immutable ledger for the world. When you talk about these resolvers, you say there's no place to see globally like what names are available or not. To be clear, though, if anyone tried to buy a name, like let's say you had two different resolvers that were showing two different things, right? Like I say, I want to buy DK, and one resolver says, oh, like DK is taken, one resolver's not. Like I could always try and buy the name DK. And if I did, I would always have like a escape hatch, last, you know, whatever, ditch, whatever answer that shows this name is already taken on Bitcoin. Is that right?
If you'd want to have a system that isn't dependent on trusting any one data availability node.
Right.
Now, maybe V1, maybe it's fine if you trust and, you know, I'll run the thing and I'll do my best to do it. Mm-hmm. But I want it to be where over time you wouldn't have to trust that I'm telling you the truth. You could discover truth and prove truth, you know, prove something is true by being
How would you prove that though? Like if you want the ultimate ground truth, do I have to try and purchase the name? Or like how do these resolvers provide that truth?
The resolvers, if they have the data availability, mm-hmm. then they can check and say, no, this one is provably owned already because like here's a proof bundle. But the proof bundle can be owned by the users, but maybe not like always available on the network. So there's like, you know, effectively, think about the style of I choose to run one and I try to serve everything possible, every name possible. Mm-hmm. I try to do that. And you can verify if I show you a name, you can take that name by yourself and verify.
Yes.
Oh, if okay. I play this on Bitcoin, I can see this is a transaction. This is like actually valid. But if I don't serve that, if nobody serves that, then somebody could actually like own a name and hide the fact that they own it from everybody else.
But if someone then tried to buy, yeah, but if someone then tried, so let's say all of the resolvers went down, but I already bought Max. If someone then tried to go and buy Max, they would, upon trying to purchase the name, realize it was already taken.
If you were to present your name when somebody tried to do that, you could see that yours was registered before, so everybody should believe that you own it and they don't.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are offline...
Yeah, let's say I'm just gone for a year.
So you'd hope that that would not be a problem, but that seems to be... Like, you need the data to be available if you want to prove that.
So your system is dependent on at least some amount of these honest nodes. Or not even honest, I guess they can prove it, but some amount of these nodes making the data
everything's
available.
Everything's verifiable. Like, if I hand you data, you can look on Bitcoin and say, yep, that actually happened. But if I don't hand you data, you can't reconstruct the state of the world without me handing you that data. So you need at least one person, one entity that's going to be making that data available.
And what do you see as a potential, like, I don't know, like if you were like thinking adversarially, like what do you see that could go wrong?
Well, I mean, I think V1, I would host a server myself and make all the data available. And every time a name got registered, I would try to also make that available. So I would be like functioning as like a good actor, but I wouldn't want that to be a dependency forever. I'd want there to be like more good actors. Now the benefit is you can compete to be a good actor and then everybody can verify, oh, this guy actually has given me the most information that I can find and I've verified it all against Bitcoin, so it's true.
Yeah.
Let's compare it to like Bitcoin and Bitcoin is money. I think that'll help us tease out whether it's the same trade-offs or what's different. But if I want to receive Bitcoin and be confident that I've received it, I mean, one option is I run my own node. Mm-hmm. That's the best option in terms of me being confident, verifiability, privacy, etc. But of course, many people, you know, there's trade-offs to running your own node, resources, etc. So many people use a wallet that connects to some other Bitcoin Core node. Often the wallet runs that node, and you're trusting it, right? You're trusting it's using the version of Bitcoin that you care about, and you're trusting that it's verifying properly. Mm-hmm. And so, in a similar fashion with the naming, I can, with your system, DK, I can always run my own resolver if I want full independence and verifiability and trust, and then I am confident. I can also rely on a third party and it would be a similar trust relationship. Maybe one, let's walk through, I haven't thought this through, so let's walk through it on the show. Now let's say I own Moneyball. So I could, run my own resolver and I'm fully confident in my ownership of it and that it exists and I can make my resolver available. And like DK, you can start the whole system by running a server and like be, you know, and be, unless you're hacked or something, you're going to be running a trusted resolver that works correctly. But let's say Max comes along and, you know, the system's evolved. There's now many resolvers.
Yeah.
And so now Max is using a resolver that, you know, whether malicious or not, somehow doesn't include Moneyball,
and I want to squat.
He loves Moneyball. So then he goes to buy it, and he will quote purchase it because his resolver won't see it on the blockchain because it's either malicious or buggy or whatever reason. Somehow it makes a mistake. It doesn't follow the protocol. Then so Max pays the money. He thinks he owns Moneyball. His resolver is telling him he owns Moneyball. But of course, he doesn't own it because what's on the blockchain? There's even an entry in the blockchain that says he owns Moneyball, except a protocol compliant, a protocol compliant resolver will not recognize it because it sees that mine came first.
Right.
And then you lost out on your money. And then some subset or whoever's using that resolver would be misled because they think Moneyball is with you and is actually with me.
So you have two networks at that point, or two standards almost.
So it's, I guess, let's see. I mean, that's not dissimilar from like if there's a wallet that had a bunch of users and that wallet's running a Bitcoin node software that is malicious or buggy or, you know, adopt some other standard or something, then every wallet connected to that or every user using that wallet connected to that node would also be deceived.
Yeah. So what happens in that case? How do you decide which is real?
Well, if you can present a proof bundle that corresponds to an early registration, then you have proven that you own it.
But I think it's just like the money case, right? I mean, the people with the money, they also could lose money. Like if you're using a wallet that's using Bitcoin software that is malicious or running a different protocol or adopts some consensus change that the rest of the network hasn't, every user of that wallet will be, in a position where they could lose money.
Yeah.
Or you know, their wallet balance shows a bunch of money, but then when they actually try to like later on, it just disappears. They try to transact it with anyone else in the world, and it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And that would be similar here. So while that's a drawback, is it any different than the money use case? And is there any reason? And so far, that's generally not been a problem with Bitcoin. And obviously, as soon as it was discovered with money wallets, it would be a massive brand hit and then everyone would bolt or whatever. And it would be similar, I think, with the naming. So is there a reason to believe this won't work out for open name tags?
I wouldn't say I'm convinced either way. It's currently the thing that I don't have a strong conviction on how to resolve it. I would say in open name tags, I've sort of presented a simplified version of what's actually going on, but there's actually a few other layers to it that add complexity and potentially create holes. But like one example is because these names, like the name Max, would be something that probably a lot of people want. The design of the protocol is that you can claim Max and you have to broadcast it and you have to let everybody know that you're trying to get Max. And if anybody wants to compete for that name, they should see within a notice window. So there's a notice window, call it 7 days maybe. So you try to buy Max, you pay 1,000 Bitcoin, about $1, that goes to miners, not to me. And you then are saying, I want to own Max. Well, you need to let other people, you need to give other Maxes a chance to try to bid if they want to actually own Max. So there's kind of a notice window. That's the way it works. So if there's a notice window, then you could say, look, I have proof that I tried to register, but you could actually try maliciously as the claimer of Max to hide the fact that you were included in a Merkle batch. And then only after the notice window comes around do you actually make it more obvious to everybody.
I mean, it seems to me that this kind of comes down to like, are there enough honest nodes in the system that people can, whatever, I don't know.
But I get, so if to the degree that there's concern, like fundamental concerns with this, why don't you have those fundamental concerns with Bitcoin as money? We just said a vulnerability in Bitcoin is like, if I create a wallet and then I get a million users using my wallet and then and they're all dependent on my Bitcoin node and I change the Bitcoin node's software to different rules or to be malicious or to lie to them and say they received money, but they didn't actually receive money. Like we've known this since 2009 when the code, so like, And yet we're diehard Bitcoiners. We believe Bitcoin's fault tolerant and resilient. And so why don't we have that confidence with ONT?
I don't think I see the perfect mapping. I think like the ethos, I think, is similar, but I don't think the details, at least in my mind, I don't see the perfect mapping. So if I saw the perfect mapping, then maybe it would be obvious. And maybe it actually is a perfect mapping and I'm just not seeing it. But I think there's something where like you're registering a unique asset, you're self-registering a unique asset that you're expecting everybody else to recognize. And so part of the protocol tries to say, I'm going to register this unique thing. There's no block reward handing it to me. I'm registering it myself.
AKA so the network NFT. He's carefully avoiding NFT.
I always need to do the cause of shitcoin.
These are assets that are not fungible. There's no token.
Almost like a non-fungible token.
Hey, have you guys heard of my new TNF? It's token non-fungible. Totally new idea I came up with.
Yeah,
but clearly, like the NFT versus fungible token, there's clearly a distinction there. I haven't thought about it enough to know if it somehow then presents new or different security trade-offs or resilience trade-offs.
Because I feel like the way you could solve this is if you say, look, I know that DK will publish the thing. So if DK didn't publish it, didn't publish Max's claim, then it wasn't like well-known enough, right? But that's obviously bad because you don't want to be reliant on one. So there needs to be some sort of like, I don't know if it's a gossip between everybody who's registered as running a resolver that can say enough. It's effectively like enough people... nodes know about this.
Why can't you just have like a challenge? So like, okay, you know, if there is one protocol and if you got in an earlier block for a name or not, then, I mean, I guess it sucks for someone if they kind of get rugged because one person kind of hid that they did it.
Yeah, you don't want that because somebody could do it day one, hide it, and then you could register it and be using it for years. And then once you built up a lot of equity value in your name, then they could be like, oh, sorry, I own that actually.
But I think that like any kind of like trust, I don't know, man, it's starting to sound Ethereum-y.
Hold on. I have a clarification. If I register Moneyball or this whole hiding it secret, I don't quite get that. I thought that the name Moneyball, I thought would actually go into the Bitcoin blockchain, but all the values mapped to it would be off chain. Is that correct or not correct?
That's not exactly correct. That was an early that was the early hypothesis. But you were pointing out, I think correctly, that having 8 billion of those name mappings on Bitcoin would not scale. And you know, with agent name mappings, it gets even more than 8 billion, right? So I think you were encouraging exploring Merkle batches, and I think we have a good Merkle batching solution, but it suffers in this way because the data is not on Bitcoin. It needs to be somewhere.
So it evolved when there's contention in the auction, then it goes on chain. Otherwise it doesn't. Is that?
Yeah. Yeah. Effectively it's sort of two paths. Like the first is I just claim a name. I pay 1,000 Bitcoin to a miner and then, you know, it opens up a window of contest. And then during that window, you can be like, oh, somebody's trying to get Moneyball. I'm going to post a L1 bond so that the things that actually have contention do show up on L1. But if most things probably never have any contention and they just happen in the Merkle batch.
So if I register Moneyball, but there's no contention, that what goes on the blockchain is I have like a leaf in a Merkle tree that gets rolled up. You know, so the Merkle root goes in the blockchain. I can prove to the world that, and that leaf has some kind of, you know, unique identifier. It also, that is then cryptographically committed to my name, Moneyball. I can then prove to the world that here's this key that was committed to the name Moneyball that was part of this Merkle tree in this Merkle root that was inserted in the blockchain on this, in this block height. Which gives me provenance, but what you guys are pointing out is I don't have to reveal the name Moneyball, and the rest of the world doesn't. The rest of the world doesn't even necessarily. They don't even necessarily see that tree or that leaf. I guess if the... Is it a resolver or is there another name for... Like when I submit this to the network, isn't there a...
That's a separate role. That's a publisher.
Publisher, but yeah. I'm going to register the name Moneyball. I work with publisher software, which I can either host myself or use a third party. I guess if I host myself, I'm going to go after the most adversarial case.
This is the problem.
So I'm going to register Moneyball. I run the publisher software. I create a Merkle tree with. That includes the name Moneyball, publish it on chain. It's a transaction, but that transaction does not have the string Moneyball, and it has no information that the public can look at to know the Moneyball has been registered.
Yep.
Now months or years could go by, and then Max is like doesn't see any evidence, public evidence that Moneyball has been registered. He's like, aha, I love that name. And there's no way for the system to prevent him from paying money to purchase it.
Yeah.
And then at any future point in time, I can be like, aha. And then, and then what?
That's the
issue.
Problem. That's the problem. So that's the, I say the crux of the issue I've been dancing around. I mean, I feel like it's been a month now and I don't have a good answer to it. And so I think there's one answer that's something around how publishers need to publish to others. And there's some sort of gossip way to solve this. I don't know exactly what that would look like, but some way to sort of have enough consensus from other publishers that data has been made available and is actually available, but we don't want to run a blockchain. So like, hopefully it's not that. So that's one answer. I think the other answer is kind of a simplification, which I also find attractive, but not necessarily scalable, which is go back to the original simple design where everything is an L1. And then only once you've caused such problems, you've got enough traction and usage of the system that you've caused these problems. Most of the early ones probably have a lot of contention anyway because people are going to be trying to register good names for themselves. So a lot of them will land on L1, build kind of proof that people care about this, and then treat scalability as like a second act, almost like a layer two or a Lightning network on top of Bitcoin instead of trying to solve both Lightning and Bitcoin at the same time.
I don't know, man. I gotta say, you're starting to sound a little bit talky there. Like, I know. Which, I mean, listen, this is a very difficult challenge, but I hear. I mean, and that's why Bitcoin is such a unique breakthrough. Right? Like, to have a global ledger is almost impossible. And obviously, I really want this to work. I increasingly come back and see why. One of our mutual friends, like the dream situation is if you could just do the ordinals, like you actually own this thing and then you can prove it to someone from the Bitcoin blockchain. But the moment you start saying, I mean, like, for example, you could do this. I mean, to your much earlier question, like would people run these? Yes, people would run resolvers. Why do I say that? Because people are already running lots of Blossom servers. In fact, you could just like make it easy for the people that are running Blossom servers. Like maybe those could be the resolvers. NOS already has like all this gossip protocol implemented. So you could do something where you say, the whole thesis of Nostr is you don't have to have global availability. You just go and see like, okay, whatever. Can I find someone bought this or not? But the challenge is once you start putting like anything complexity in there where it's like, well, there needs to be some threshold of these nodes that say that. It's like, well, who decides the nodes?
The complexity is global state versus non. Nostr doesn't try to represent global state. It's just like here's something that was said, whereas in a namespace, you do need global state to some extent, right?
And it seems to me that global state, like the only thing I've ever known that's gotten global state is Bitcoin. And I don't know.
Also, we've talked about the auction, to prevent a single actor from squatting on, even if you have to pay a bond, prevent them from squatting on like the top 100,000 names or whatever. But if that single actor runs their own publisher, it's like unbeknownst to the to the rest of the world, and they could that there'd be no. I guess even if I run my own publisher software, it still has to go through this. There's some public marker on the blockchain to notify that there's this a window of time. So let's walk through that. What is that marker? So let's say this average sale case where I'm running my own publisher, I'm registering Moneyball, I'm not revealing Moneyball. Well, how does the auction work if I don't reveal Moneyball?
The auction can only work if enough people see it, right? So that's, there's sort of like, I'd say there's either you have resolvers and initially there's only one and you trust it, but eventually there's maybe many resolvers and you don't have to trust any given one and you can run your own. But if it's not getting to enough, whatever that, how you define that threshold, but some sort of form of consensus on this was published, then you actually can hide it, right? So you want to prevent that.
Right, but how does the protocol how does the protocol guarantee an auction happens? If I just run the publisher software and sneak in this transaction on chain, and then like 30 days later, no one was made aware that there was...
Right. That's the hiding. That's exactly the question. Yeah. Well, is it better to just default back to L1 everything and worry about scalability as a separate issue?
But wouldn't the protocol, I want to make sure I have this correct. In that case where I'm trying to be malicious and hide it, if I publish that the auction is starting, can't you guarantee that anyone that does decide to run their own, whatever you're calling it, validator software, would see that? So you could know that as long as I'm running my own software, I could see every single name that's ever been, had never had an auction start. Is that true?
You can't, but the person who's publishing it may hide the fact that they published it.
But hold on. Why not have it be defined in the protocol spec?
Exactly.
That to be a valid registration, there has to be some public marker in the Bitcoin transaction that says, this is ONT.
And anyone that runs any of the different resolver software would see that.
And and then if you see that, then you know it's ONT. And then there also be a requirement that the tree and all the leaves are made available.
Available to who?
Well, to
anyone running the resolver software. And you could have a trust assumption where it's N of one, right? Where you just say anyone that's running the resolver software would see every single name that's ever been announced for an auction. And then it's, I guess, maybe kind of like Spark or something. I don't know, like where you're like, I am probably trusting people, but if I wanted to, I could have zero trust.
So let's see. Let's run this through. So let's say I'm adversarial, you know, I'm the bad actor, I'm running the publisher, and let's say we add this requirement in the protocol to there's some flag.
Yeah.
I put the flag in, but I still don't make the tree and the names available. Now, other resolvers on the network and publishers see the flag in the transaction. They're like, oh, we care about this one. And then they can't find the data. What do they do when they can't find the data?
Yeah, like it seems like they should scream like bloody murder. Somebody's hiding, right?
Red Realm. But to be clear, if you went back, and obviously this would take more block space, but if you just kept every name, could you not still have a way to have a Merkle tree? But, I mean, could you not
the issue
still
is
have...
once you start doing a Merkle tree, you're saying the data is not going to be on Bitcoin, it's going to be somewhere else.
Yeah, but you could and still then go and check. Like if I have to announce an auction is made for my name, it's part of a Merkle tree, I should be able, as someone running the resolver software, to check if I can find what that name was because someone else made it available, like the resolver layers. And if no one's made it available, maybe there's like some red flag where I can, I don't know, point out no one's publishing what the name was.
So I think that could be figured out. But then there's, you know, is it a requirement of the protocol to be Bitcoin-like and that anyone can join in the future? and from scratch build like this validation node. And
if you want it to be global,
you can't with Bitcoin, you can independently do that.
Right.
With this, you can't. Because like if even if we like change the protocol so that when I publish to register stuff, I have to make it available for some period of time or whatever, and the other existing publishers and resolvers see it and they can even cache it. But then like, you know, a year later, someone else joins the network, that data might not be available anymore.
Yeah.
So they're trusting something else to get that data.
But isn't there some analogy though, like with initial block downloads? Like you seed it with a few IPs that you trust and you start asking and you can verify, oh, you handed me a block and I can compute why that block is actually valid. So you can do that. And so you could create some sort of a sequence of things that are cryptographically connected so that somebody can't break the sequence, but
you're not, you can use any, you're not, yeah, I need to think about that more.
I keep going back and forth. Like it feels like it creates too much trust and then I'm not sure. Maybe if it were a vibrant system where everybody was using it, it would kind of work similar to how Bitcoin works. I'm just not convinced either way yet.
In general, I think like when we hit design constraints like this, it's far more productive to be in Buzz where we can like
ask
agents as well.
I'm curious. What does Fable say, number one? And then number two, if you kept everything L1, like just order of magnitude, like how much could you scale that? Like if you had to have the name in the transaction.
Right. I've been back and forth with Fable on this and it keeps pointing it out and it's asking for basically a call on it, but I don't have necessarily the call.
What's its call? It's smarter than we are. What does it have to say?
I've asked it that it doesn't have, I would say I've asked it that, you know, dozens of times in different ways and I've not gotten something I'm satisfied with.
It's actually, DK, I'm thinking a little bit more about what we were getting stumped on there. I mean, the difference between like Bitcoin protocol and what you've developed is that there's a gossip network and a peer-to-peer network. So if you added a gossip and peer-to-peer network, ONT, then I think you could do this.
You're saying you could do this?
Well, with this kind of, when I install Bitcoin software, I can I can connect to the peer-to-peer network and I can download blocks. I mean, by default, I think it's like 8 different peers randomly right. selected, although you can like do some adjustments to favor this or that network, right. like Tor, or, you know, whatever. And you can go beyond 8 right. and the blocks are coming from, each block is coming from different peers. Right. And the reason you get independent verification is because when you sum it all up, it has to make sense. If you get served a bad block by a bad peer, it will be revealed because then the cryptography doesn't line up. Right. So it's not dependent on trusting any node. Even if you're seeded with like start with, you know, this node to find other peers, you're not trusting like that node exclusively. But there's a peer-to-peer gossip network. I've not yet heard you say there's a peer-to-peer gossip network publishers and resolvers.
I mean, you said you were thinking about adding that.
Yeah, that was kind of like my best guess at how this could be solved is, you know, effectively very parallel to how Bitcoin solves it. But I'm kind of looking for gotchas or things that you guys would think are problematic about that. Because like, I mean, similarly, imagine, you know, day one of Bitcoin, you've got Bitcoin running. There's only one, you're trusting it. You say, I want to volunteer and participate, but you have to get your IP seeded, right? But once you have the data, you can also retransmit the data and everybody who receives the data can verify cryptographically that that's true, that that's the true state, right? So maybe it is resolvers should work similar to Bitcoin with their own gossip protocol to
That's interesting.
Broadcast each other's availability. I guess there's still the problem though that people could You could try to be hiding it. You could say that you were trying to get included in the gossip, and the other players would not participate with you, I guess.
Yeah.
So back to my other question. What's like the back of the envelope math for if you had to, like we talked about in the past, something like inscriptions or something like that. If you wanted to just inscribe every name on the blockchain, yes, it doesn't scale as well, but like what order of magnitude of names could you get per block from that?
I'd have to relook. I did this analysis many months ago, and I think it could get to millions of names pretty easily without feeling like it was much of an impact. Maybe 5% of block space or something like that could get you millions registered per year. You know, something on that order, which is not maybe good enough for real scalability, but it may be good enough to start and then solve
and then
these.
You can always solve it later. Yeah,
other things later.
The math is pretty simple. So you can store maximum of 4 megabytes in a block, and that's if you're able to use witness data
and all that. Yeah.
So like, what's a reasonable assumption for the length of the average string?
5 characters.
Maybe like 200 bytes.
Interesting. I was going to say 20. So we have 5, 20, and 200. Why 200? I don't get, like, how can it be possibly 5?
Definitely like 32 characters, right?
Sorry, what's 32?
Like the name.
Okay.
If you spec the name as 32 characters, and then some sort of owner key that is like a public key that defines ownership of the things. You're saying this, it's basically a key value pair. This name maps to this public key, right? That would be what you'd want to write to the blockchain.
Okay. So that'd be like 100 bytes then. Like the key is like 64 bytes.
Okay. Fair.
Yeah. Okay. So let's call it, 100 bytes. That sounds reasonable. Yeah. What's 4 million divided by 100? Well, that's 400,000, 40,000. So 40,000 names per block.
If you were only using...
maxed out the block size. I mean, there's a bunch of overhead too, but like for swagging...
Order of magnitude, yeah.
What did I say? 40,000 per block. But if we want to do 5%, something more realistic that would be like... 2,000. You know, acceptable.
So 2,000 names a block.
And then... So 2,000, and then so 100? So 200,000 a day.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
Well, yeah. What was it? 2,000 per block. Is that what we decided?
Yeah, 2,000 per block.
And then
how many blocks a day?
144
or 6 blocks.
But there's like 50,000 in a year.
Yeah, yeah.
So 100,000 times 2,000, 200 million. So okay. 100 million.
So we're on the order of
100 million a year.
I mean, I know agents are going to need more, but that's
just the registrations. But in order to get the registration, given that there's some contention, there's other block space for the bidding, and which are, you know, arguably payment use cases of Bitcoin. So, different people may feel different ways about it. But there are like, bonding and bidding, sequences that would impact block space too.
What about, I mean, how much have you explored with the agents on creating your own blockchain?
Zero.
Is that a joke?
I haven't looked at that.
What do you mean?
Like one that chooses different trade-offs.
Yeah.
Like larger blocks, it's gonna require more money to run a node. Mm-hmm. So you're not gonna get the degree of decentralization that Bitcoin would offer, but arguably enough to... to have enough decentralization.
I would say that's not a true global namespace then. Like if you...
Spiral funds a project like this, creating another blockchain.
I'm learning everyone's Vitalik now. What is this?
Braidpool.
We talked about that like on one of our first episodes. Yeah.
Yeah. It has its own separate blockchain.
I didn't realize that.
And
it's very, very fast, right? Like short and fast.
Yeah. So like it has tokens.
Uh-oh.
And the tokens are, because Bitcoin already has tokens. Like mining shares already exist. Mm-hmm. Like the way miners and mining pools work, there's shares. Call them shares, call them tokens, right. Same thing. Braidpool also has shares, tokens,
and it has a blockchain. Is it just a merge mine?
The difference... I don't think so.
Yeah.
I mean, it's its own separate blockchain, but the...
Then how does it interact with Bitcoin? How does it interact with Bitcoin?
Well, if it's built and adopted, then it would be the miners of Bitcoin. Like, every miner would become, like, their own pool.
Isn't that merge mining?
No.
Like, merge mining, like, using all the existing Bitcoin miners to mine blocks in this new blockchain?
Maybe. I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, that's not the core concept of it, though. But I guess my point is, like, is it ethical or unethical or whatever? Braid Pool doesn't have, like, VC investors and founders who get pre-mined tokens. There's no pre-mining of tokens.
Right.
This would not be listed on an exchange and try to pump up the number.
Yeah.
It's directly tied to mining shares. It would have economic value, but right. The exact same economic value that already exists on mining shares.
To be clear, I'm less concerned about that piece of like the VCs and the ethics obviously matter, but like, I think to me, it's more of a question of like, it's always a spectrum, obviously, of trust and decentralization. But like, if you want this to be a truly global namespace, like imagine you bought a name, died, but you were cryogenically frozen and you were going to come back in 1,000 years. If you want to have the same degree of confidence, I'm going to own this name as with Bitcoin. That to me is a very different system than, oh, this is like a cool blockchain. It's got some value. It's just like, and that's fine. I mean, you know, those are both reasonable projects to pursue. But if you really want to build, you know, humanity and our legacy's final naming system, then I think it needs to have the Bitcoin level of security.
Well, but Bitcoin doesn't scale either.
Well,
right?
So the
guarantees you get with on-chain is different than Lightning, and Lightning is different than Arc, and Arc is different than Spark, and it's different than Cashew.
We're thinking on a civilizational timescale, I actually think Danny's point might be right then. Like, the answer is just wait till all of the Bitcoin are mined, all of the ordinals are out there, and like, in 100 years, we'll have that. Which I understand that sucks, because right now we're not, you know, we may or may not be in 100 years.
And use it, yeah. It might be hard to get enough momentum of usage if nobody alive today can use it. Like 50 years from now.
And that's totally fine. But if you do zoom out and think, what will be used on the civilizational timescale, ordinal seems far stronger to me. And I get it. Like, we don't want to wait 100 years, but.
Anyway, we're way over. So maybe we wrap.
Okay, yes. Thanks for the feedback on that.
Yeah, this was a live workshop on PPJ.
I think following up on Buzz is will help us.
Yeah.
It'll be productive.
Right.
Okay.
Let's do it.
See you guys.
Bye.
Okay, see ya.